y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of murder, murder by slashing, stabbing, or strangulation, body mutilation, dismemberment, cannibalism, and sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised.
We just want to give an extra special thank you to Olivia for helping to research and write up this case. She and Mark did an amazing job, and we could not do any of this without you, so thank you guys so much. In February of 2004, the body of a nude woman was discovered near an agricultural research station for Louisiana State University, or LSU. The crime scene was processed, and it was discovered that the woman had suffered a deep slash to her neck, and there were ligature marks all around her neck. Her body had been positioned in a way so that the trauma to her genitals would clearly be seen by anyone who found her. Investigators found signs that she had been dragged to the scene, tire tracks nearby, and 13 empty beer cans. The body was determined to be Donna Johnston, and she was the final victim of Sean Vincent Gillis's 10-year killing spree.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Yikes.
It's always that three names.
I know. I was going to say, you know that it's going to be a serial killer when you got the three names.
I know.
And, like, they don't all go by the three names. Like, no. They are known by the three names. I wonder why that's a thing with serial killers.
I had a theory, because I was thinking about this. I think because maybe there are other Sean Gillises in the world, and they want to differentiate and be like, if you look up Sean Gillis, and then you find, you know, like, I think that it's like...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
A kindness to the other Sean Gillises of the world.
Because
he just went by Sean.
Right. But yeah, I think it's like, you're not going to get confused if you meet a Sean Gillis and you're like, excuse me?
Exactly. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, we have a Hey Girl Thanks, a couple of them. So Hey Girl Thanks to Olivia for requesting this.
Yes.
This is our writer, Olivia. She lives in Louisiana, so this is a backyard case for her.
Yes.
Essentially.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, especially when we start talking about how many serial killers were active in this area at one time. Jeez.
But then also, hey girl, thanks to
Mark.
Mark for writing it up.
Thank you. Okay, so let's jump into it.
Yes.
Sean Vincent Gillis was born on June 24th, 1962, to parents Norman and Yvonne Gillis in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Calling on Baton Rouge.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's one of the best songs.
I know. Brooks.
His childhood was unstable because his father struggled with severe mental illness and alcohol abuse. Shortly after Gillis was born, his father left him and his mother struggled as a single mother, but she and his grandparents did their best to make sure that he had a normal, happy childhood. Yvonne worked at a local television station writing commercials and bought a home in a nice neighborhood close to LSU. Yvonne was a Catholic, and it was important to her to raise Sean in the religion and get an education in the same vein. She made sacrifices to ensure that she could save money and make sure that he could attend a local private Catholic school. In his early years, Sean seemed like a normal child to Yvonne, even though he was teased at school for not having a father around. Do better, children.
Yeah, it's not his fault.
Yeah. Oh, your dad's not around.
Like, that's not even a sick burn. That's just mean.
It's not a sick burn. Yeah. Like, that just shows you're an asshole, basically. Definitely. He loved when she read him the great literary works of Edgar Allan Poe, Ernest Hemingway, William Shakespeare, and Charles Dickens. He also enjoyed playing with model cars and watching Star Trek.
Who doesn't?
Star Trek should be in the McDonald triad at this point.
Well, yeah.
Just kidding. But he really did like Star Trek.
Well,
she thought he was so respectful and even a genius, even though he only made average grades at school. This is like, mother-son.
Yeah. Like he hung the moon. Yes.
Yeah.
They should have done mother-boy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. In junior high, his two best friends described him as smart with a great sense of humor. They spent their time hanging out at a local mall and movie theater and at each other's homes talking about girls. But neighbors and other people who knew Sean had different thoughts and said Sean gave the neighborhood kids the creeps, and they witnessed him doing strange things as he got older, such as knocking on random doors, yelling at cars, banging on garbage cans in the middle of the night.
It's like a friggin' raccoon. Like, quit it.
Yeah, what are you doing out there, man? He's always been nocturnal, though, hasn't he?
Yes, he has.
Seems, yeah. Maybe he is a little possum or something.
I know.
His mother seemed to ignore the negative things anyone said about her son. He was just perfect in her eyes.
Jeez.
After 16 years of not seeing his son, Norman came back to his family for the funeral of his father, Norman Sr. This is when Sean met his father for the first time. Norman had been in and out of several mental institutions over the years and was finally well enough to hold a job and live a fairly normal life. He ended up becoming a minister and later would carry a Bible around at Sean's trial. After they met, Norman began coming around more often to spend time with his son. And they seemed like they were starting to form a pretty good relationship, but unfortunately, Norman relapsed. After his relapse, Sean was going through some of his father's belongings, and he found some gay pornography. And this is how he found out that his father was actually gay. Now, this greatly affected Sean and his thoughts on anything, really, having to do with sexual orientation. He had some wild thoughts about things. But he became super, super homophobic after finding out this information, and it caused him to basically form a grudge against his father, even though they'd been building this good relationship prior to this. After going to rehab, Norman went back to live in California when it became clear that neither Yvonne nor Sean wanted anything to do with him. Sean was arrested several times throughout his early years, beginning when he was 17, a senior in high school. The convictions ranged from traffic citations and DUI to possession of the devil's lettuce.
I think that's bad.
Uh-oh. And contempt of court. His early arrest and convictions were considered to be nonviolent. After graduation, he continued living with his mother, began working various jobs when he felt like it. That's the key there.
Mm-hmm.
And got a certification from a community college in computer courses. And, you know, at this time, like, computers were...
They're not what they are now.
Yeah, no, they are now. However, once he had the World Wide Web at his fingertips, he discovered that online, there was porn. And so he was like, cancel all my plans. I'm just gonna do porn today.
I've definitely done that, except not with porn. It was with The Sims.
Oh, sure.
Right?
We spent some consecutive days in our pajamas playing The Sims.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So imagine that, but just instead with porn. Sometimes he just wouldn't even show up to work because he was at home just watching porn all day. Like it took all of his time.
What? Why? I don't understand. It's not. I don't know. Porn can be great if you watch it, you know, whatever. There's no like porn shaming going on here. But like, how do you watch it all the live long day?
Well, it's just like that episode in Friends when Joey and Chandler got the free porn and they were afraid to turn the TV off. And
so they
just
it.
Like had to. Yeah. Because like, what if they lost it? So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously like porn addiction is a real thing.
Yes.
Clearly this man had that. I mean, because it's affecting his life in negative ways. Like,
right.
He's not even going to work. He's not taking care of himself. He's not taking care of responsibilities in his life because...
He's just watching porn all day.
He's too busy watching porn. Yeah. So at this point, his mother just started enabling him and did so for the next 10 years. She let him live with her. She financially supported him completely. And even after she moved to Atlanta for a better job opportunity, she still agreed to pay for the house while he lived there. He did nothing.
I will say this because you guys have given me permission to talk about kids, even though I'm not a parent. Giving your children, from what I've seen, giving your children everything that they could have ever wanted and not having any repercussions or any responsibilities does not make for fun adults. Because I have been around some adults that you can tell, like, they never heard the word no in their entire mm-hmm. lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, this
How about you don't tell me how to parent my kids?
You don't even have kids.
No. But, I mean, yeah, because that's like, the job of a parent is to raise a person who can go out into the world.
Right. Like a fully functional and I don't know what's the right word, but like, you know, somebody who contributes to society in some way and mm-hmm. like self-sufficient.
Everything that we do is supposed to, it is leading up to when they don't need us anymore, which is like, you know, heartbreaking in a way.
Sure.
But that's what, like,
that's the job,
you know?
Right?
And of course, like, if you have a child who has a severe medical issue and stuff, like, your job is simply to just take care of them, of course. Like, not every child is going to be able to do that. Sean had no barrier to working other mm-hmm. than he just did not want to.
And he never.
And she paid for everything. He didn't work at all. So because I was thinking about this the other day, like, well, how was he? Like, she had to have been giving him money for food and.
I would think.
Because he just did not work.
No. Mm-mm.
Yeah. So remember how he kind of did some like weird stuff when his mom lived there and she was just like, no, he didn't. Once she moved to Atlanta, his shit got weirder. It got worse. So neighbors said that they would see him howling at the moon and cursing his mother in the middle of the night, peeping into windows, having wild parties where he was suspected of dealing drugs and trashing the house. And you want to talk about trashing this house? Like, it was bad. And then soon, like his father, he developed a drinking problem and he could no longer keep a steady job, which I would
Not
argue
that he
couldn't
to.
Keep a steady job before.
Yeah.
Like now he's got the porn and just simply not wanting to work. And now he's also got an alcohol problem. So it's just compounding. Around this time, Gillis began a 10-year relationship with a woman named Terry. Their relationship, although long, suffered because of his addiction to pornography, which made him not want to have sex with his girlfriend. She said they only had sex a few times in 10 years. And she said, I saw an interview with her where she said that he told her that the way that he was raised was that sex was a nasty thing and you just don't do it. And so...
erroneous, though. Like, I don't... I mean, maybe, well, right. but I don't... Yeah. He didn't and believe
also,
that.
It's just... It's like, well, if it's so nasty, then why do you spend 99% of your time watching it occur online?
Good point.
So, I mean, obviously, he's just telling her what he can to... Wouldn't you think you'd want to have sex if you got a girlfriend? Like, if he could never get a girlfriend, that'd be one thing. But it's like, here she is. She wants to have sex with you. She would like to have sex with you.
Yeah, I have experienced in my life, I dated someone who had a porn addiction, and it was the exact same thing. It was like the real thing was not good. And like, it just, yeah, I don't yeah. understand
and
it.
And obviously, but yeah, that's some kind of a, yeah.
Yeah.
addiction thing, I guess, but like it's just yeah. wild to
well,
me.
Well, and like somebody who's like me being in it, I was like, hello,
like I'm actually here.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And Terry just kind of chalked it up to that's just how Sean is. She did that with a lot of stuff. And she felt like he showed her affection in other ways. So she didn't really hold the sex thing too high, like put way too much weight in it. Terry ended up getting him a job with her at a Circle K convenience store across from St. James Place Assisted Living Facility near the LSU campus. And she worked there. So when he wasn't working, he stayed on his computer for up to 48 hours at a time sometimes, eventually looking up really fucked up websites that would show photos of naked, dead women. Terry knew about this, but decided that the good outweighed the bad. And so she didn't really think much of it. She tried to just put those things out of her mind. And one of the reasons she did that was because Sean had also helped her to reconnect with her three children that she had like no longer had custody of before they met. So she felt like she had a real family with him. And it really is sad because you look at like all the things that she ignored, explained away, all these things, because she really did love him.
Yeah.
And she wanted
to make
love
it work
too.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just sad. Little did she know, though, that he was driving the streets in bad parts of town looking for sex workers that he could make his victims. So she worked the night shift. And when he, at one point, he worked at Circle K. He was extremely unreliable, never mm-hmm. wanted to come into work. He just didn't feel like it.
Well, and even when he was at work, he was not a good employee. Like he was, I mean, the manager was like, he was just lazy. He didn't want to do anything.
And so finally, either he left or got fired. I forget what, I mean, maybe he just stopped coming to work. I don't really remember. And then he just would stay home. And so he would drive Terry to and from her night shift. And she really didn't ask him what he was doing. And he's not working, so she's paying everything.
Mm-hmm.
They live together at this point, and when she moved into his house, she had to completely renovate it because he had completely like trashed it to the point that like and it had some hurricane damage.
Yeah, I was gonna say Hurricane Andrew, I think, had hit, and mm-hmm. he hadn't fixed it up. Since
but he
then.
Didn't do anything. Yeah, it's like there's just open water damage everywhere, and he just sort of lived like that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, she did everything.
Mm-hmm. Everything. On March 21st, 1994, 81-year-old Ann Bryan was found dead on the floor of her bedroom by staff of the St. James Place Assisted Living Facility. Ann was described as a sweet old lady who loved playing bridge and Scrabble, a talented artist, even though she only had one hand. That is amazing. And well-liked by the friends that she had made in the 5 years since she had been living at St. James Place. She and other residents felt incredibly safe in the community, so she usually left her door unlocked at night. For some reason, the staff waited for an hour to call in the death, and they did not mention it was a homicide, so it took longer for law enforcement to get there.
And at first, you think maybe they didn't realize it was a homicide, but...
But listen to this.
How did she die?
Anne had been brutally stabbed 47 times, and her body parts had been viciously mutilated. You don't go into a scene like that and say, man, she must have just passed away in her sleep.
Passed in her sleep. I mean, she was 81.
Struck down in her prime. Like,
and certainly when you call, I'm assuming 911, you're like, oh my God, she's been stabbed. There's blood everywhere. Like,
yes.
What did they say?
I don't know.
Hey, just reporting a death here at the assisted living.
Right.
Get over here whenever you can.
Yeah. Like, I don't get it. I do not get it, but whatever. That's what happened.
Yep.
Her throat had been slashed to the point where she was nearly decapitated and she was nearly disemboweled. Her body had been posed to fully expose her genitals, and there was no sign of any sexual assault. After he was caught, Gillis disclosed that he tried to sexually assault her, but she started screaming and he needed to silence her. Everything in the apartment seemed to be completely normal except the bedroom, and the only evidence at the scene was an imprint of a knife in blood and bloody shoe prints. Neighbors and staff at the facility were questioned, but nothing seemed out of the ordinary, and no one had seen or heard anything unusual.
All right. On January 4th, 1999, Gillis picked up a sex worker named Catherine Hall from the north side of Baton Rouge. He told her he wanted oral sex and took her to a secluded area. There, he wrapped an industrial nylon zip tie around her neck and began strangling her. She was able to fight her way out of his car and started screaming and running through a field, but unfortunately, Gillis was able to catch up with her. That is, I can't imagine the terror any of these women felt, but like, you get out of the car.
Mm-hmm. And you think, this is my second chance, you know, like, I'm good to go. And then he,
it's so sad.
It is.
He ended up slashing her throat, which killed her, and then he began mutilating her body. He hung her leather jacket on a fence and took her clothes with him to dispose of later. Then he put her back in his car, drove to a car wash to clean her blood off his seat, and posed her dead body in the street. No one saw or heard anything. The following day, a squirrel hunter discovered Catherine's nude and mutilated body lying in the street next to a dead end sign. Now, he did this on purpose. Mm-hmm. When law enforcement got there and they see her posed in the way that she was, right underneath the dead end sign, they knew that whoever did this was making some kind of a sick fucking joke, like, see what I did here?
Yeah.
See the dead end, but she's dead, but it's also like a dead end. Like,
wow, you should be a comedian, dude. Like, that, yeah.
Catherine's cause of death was a stab wound to her jugular vein, and she was identified by her fingerprints. There was no other evidence at the scene other than her jacket. Her case went cold, and it wouldn't be until years later that they would discover a pubic hair with the root ball attached belonging to the killer in Catherine's mouth. Gross.
I know. I was going to say, it's just, even the phrase root ball, I don't love that all by itself. But the fact that it was a pubic hair in her mouth, like,
well, and I'm not trying to get like real nasty.
Yes, you are.
Well, but if you think about this.
Yeah.
For a pubic hair to be plucked by the root, with the root still intact, to have come off of him and into her mouth. How forcefully are we doing things here? I don't think that's normal.
At the very least, it's terrible. I don't know. Yeah. But it's just
like, you think about like, if you have a like wild hair or whatever, and you're like, oh fuck, I gotta pluck that or whatever. Like,
some force has to happen.
You
can get it.
You gotta pull with some force. But like, pubic hair is not like that. Sometimes the wax person has to make more than one pass. I've done waxes before, like on people. Like, those suckers are in there. And for that to just have come out into her mouth, Jesus.
I know.
I don't like that at all. I do not like that.
No, nobody does, Terrella. Nobody does. 52-year-old Hardy Mosley Schmidt was married and a stay-at-home mother of three from an affluent family. She married an attorney and her father was a family court judge. She was an avid runner and had even attended the Boston Marathon previously. On May 30th, 1999, Hardy was going for her early morning run around 5 a.m. through her upper middle class neighborhood. That is a early run. She felt safe and was completely unaware that for the previous month, she was being watched by a predator waiting for the perfect opportunity to strike. That is terrifying. It's so terrible.
Terrifying. And like, that's the thing, you know, you hear, again, personally, we don't believe in jogging, but there are people that do, but you hear, you know, take different routes. If you're a woman, go at different times.
Yeah.
Like, don't have a predictable route and don't go at the same time every day and like all this stuff. And it's like, what if we lived in a world where we could just fucking go for a jog?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? No, I still wouldn't do it, but, no. A brisk walk, maybe. I've mm-hmm. been trying out my chicken legs. I realized that I am part chicken, and I just sometimes walk around my yard. Long
it's
time
a big yard though. It's
it a is yard. A big yard, yes. But I'll do a couple laps just to get my heart rate up, you know.
Exactly. Like it's just she's just going for a jog. Like
I know.
Mind she's stay at home mom. She's getting up before her damn kids get up.
Yeah.
Nothing against her kids, but you know what I mean? Like, she's doing what she can to still make time for herself while being a stay-at-home mom for these three kids. Her husband's an attorney, so he's probably working all the time. And the only time she has to go for a jog is 5 a.m. And Sean Gillis says,
perfect.
You're going to lose your life over this.
Yeah.
Because it's convenient for me.
Yeah. And he's been watching her and waiting for the perfect moment. Like, what a piece.
So if he's been watching her, he probably knows she has kids. And
yeah, I'm sure he does. Yeah. I hate fucking this guy. Asshole. I hate this guy. And I hate his mustache.
Yeah. He's yuck.
He is a complete disgust, a garbage pail person. Gillis crept up behind her in his car, then suddenly gunned it and hit her. Hardy flew into the ditch and never had the chance to get up and outrun him. He jumped out of his car and tightened an industrial zip tie around her neck until she took her last breath. Again, no one saw or heard anything. He was
in a neighborhood.
But I mean, he picked a time that it's not going to, you know, I'm guessing a lot of people aren't up and about at 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I guess if you hit a person with your car like that, obviously it didn't make a lot of noise. I don't know.
I guess not.
It's crazy.
He obviously was getting more brazen and he had gotten away with it again. Gillis put her body in the trunk of his car to drive around and find a place where he could, quote, play with the body. Disgusting. He knew he didn't have much time because he was due to pick Terry up from her night shift at the convenience store soon. So he drove to a local park and took her body out of the car, laid it on the ground, then defiled her body. He put her back in the trunk and then went to pick up Terry. And he continued to drive around with the body in the trunk until the next day. And Terry could smell something and she asked what smelled so bad. So he told her that he had run over a squirrel and would wash it off at a car wash. And then he dropped her off at home. He drove to St. James Parish, a rural area near Baton Rouge, and dumped her body in a swamp. Her body was found the next day and her husband became the prime suspect, even though he had reported her missing as soon as she didn't come back from her run the previous morning. So sad. Insult to injury for that poor husband.
Absolutely. Yeah. In November of 1999, Gillis was out driving and looking for his next victim while Terry was at work. He started following Joyce Williams, a sex worker who was out walking. She got in the car with him, and for a while, they just rode around drinking, smoking. They were singing along to 60s music. Joyce had two children and had been in college at Southern University working toward a degree. She eventually fell on some hard times after getting into drugs and started living and working on the streets. Gillis kept driving farther and farther. He ended up in a sugarcane field near the levee in West Baton Rouge. And that's when Joyce began getting uncomfortable. They got out of the car, and while Joyce was walking ahead, Gillis slipped his weapon of choice, an industrial zip tie, around her neck and strangled her. He put her back in the passenger seat once he was sure she was dead, but this time he took her to his and Terry's home, where he proceeded to dismember her and play with her body parts for several hours.
Quit it. Quit that. Stop it.
He said that she, quote, had nice legs and he wanted to keep them. And he actually said in this interrogation or confession with the homicide detectives, he's like, you know, I like a nice set of gams, right? So.
Now, that all by itself, that's not a big deal. That's not bad. Because we all have our, you know, things that we find attractive on other people, right? The issue that happens is when you decide that you want to take them off of the person and keep them for your, like, what are you doing? The fuck are you doing, Sean? Legs. No, we don't keep. And the fact that you have to say it out loud.
Right. And he just, like, the way he talked about it, it kind of reminded me of, oh man, what is that other guy's name?
Sam Little.
Yes, thank you. Because he had a thing with throat or whatever, and he would talk about whatever. So Sean is talking to this detective, and he's just like, you know, the curvature of her legs, you know what I'm talking about? It's just beautiful. And like, I just, and but to call him Gant, yeah. Gillis again mangled pieces of her body and also decided to eat some pieces. Then he cleaned up and put her body parts in plastic bags in his trunk because it was time to go pick up Terry.
Jeez.
When he dropped Terry off at home, he went back out to dispose of the bags in Iberville Parish about 40 minutes away. Like, what is he telling Terry? Like, she's like, what the fuck do you have to do? You don't have a job. Like, where are you going? Mm-hmm. But she said in an interview that I saw with her, she's like, he would, you know, he'd pick me up, I'd go home, and then I'd go to bed because I've been working all night.
Well, like, and she also says that she had epilepsy and that took a lot out of her. And so she would, you know, just physically, she has these issues that, you know, it's like that's going to take a toll on her. And she kind of had to think about her health over other things. Like, you know, she just wasn't. Yeah.
And, you know, she just knew, like, Sean's going to do what he wants to do, you know, like, okay, well, I'm going to bed anyway. So I guess he can go do whatever he wants to go do. Like, I don't know. So her leg bone was discovered on January 22nd, 2000 by two men walking through the woods by the levee. Then 4 days later, the rest of her skeletal remains were discovered and she was identified by dental records. No other evidence was recovered at the scene, but a man loitering at the crime scene in his car was searched and became the prime suspect. Law enforcement thought he was suspicious because, as we know, it's common for killers to kind of return to the crime scene. They want to get involved with the investigation or watch, see what's going on. And this man actually had several tools in his car that law enforcement thought could have been used for dismemberment.
Bad day to take your hacksaw for a drive, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Other rumors came out that maybe another person had killed Joyce over, like, some stolen drugs. Both suspects were questioned, passed polygraph test, and were ruled out, and the case eventually went cold.
Gillis's next victim was Lillian Robinson. Lillian had what many described as a, quote, wonderful life with a close-knit family who loved her. She had two grown children and a grandchild that she loved doting on. She spent or enjoyed spending time with her sisters and going to church, but at one point or another, she started drinking. And then it grew into more of a problem, which led her down the road to drug use. And from there, her life went downhill. And Lillian began working on the streets in North Baton Rouge to support her addictions. Lillian was reported missing by her two sisters after she wasn't returning their calls in January of 2000. Gillis had gotten her in the car with him like the others before her, and he strangled her with a zip tie. He again brought her dead body home with him to, quote, play, but he realized that he didn't have enough time to dismember her and clean up before it was time to pick up Terry from work. I'm guessing it's the same time she gets, right? A lot of people have, like, the same shift, right? It'll work, like, I don't know, 11 to whatever. Doesn't he know? And I'm not saying that he should have, like, well, that's just poor planning, but it's like, you know what I mean? I don't know. I'm like,
it seemed to sneak up on him every time.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And like,
yeah,
I'm not hoping, like, that he had more time so he could, you know, whatever, but.
Right. And Terry said there were plenty of times where he was just super late and she'd just have to sit there and wait.
A piece of, for so many reasons, but I fucking hate this guy. I hate him. Yep. So for the next hour, he played with the body outside. Then when he was done, because, you know, he's not going to not do it. He's just going to pick another place where he doesn't have to do the cleanup. Mm-hmm. When he was done, he put her back in his car and drove to the Atchafalaya Basin, the largest swamp in America, where he dumped her over a bridge. He thought maybe the alligators would take care of the rest. And then he goes and picks up Terry. In March, a fisherman found her body floating several miles from where she was dumped. East Baton Rouge Parish had not been notified because her body was discovered in a different jurisdiction and had not been identified. Her family would not find out until years later that she had actually been found.
That is so sad.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what her sisters, because they're the ones that reported her missing. Like, people were looking for her.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Gillis was on his way to visit his goddaughter in New Iberia, Louisiana, when he saw 38-year-old Marilyn Nevels walking down the street. He offered her a ride and money for sex. He drove to an abandoned field and strangled her with a zip tie. But this time, the zip tie wouldn't lock, so Marilyn began fighting for her life. She fought so hard that she managed to break the right side of his windshield and get out of the car. She ran across the field, but Gillis caught up with her and beat her to death with a piece of rebar he had picked up during the chase. Again, it's like so close. Like,
I know.
And then he catches up and finds a piece of rebar.
Yeah, I was going to say, the odds of him finding that rebar during the chase is wild to me.
Exactly. As he did before with Catherine Hall, he put her back in his car, drove to a car wash, and put her on the ground while he cleaned her car or his car.
That is bold.
I mean, I guess you're just assuming that nobody else is going to come up to this car wash at any time.
Right.
It is bold. It's almost like wanting to get caught, you would think.
Well, yeah. What is that show where there's that skunk and he's like, try and catch me, biatch? Like, that's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is it Clone High? No.
I don't remember what it is.
But you remember what I'm talking about. But yeah, that's, I feel like that's what he's doing. He's like, try and catch me, biatch.
Yeah, like putting a human body on the ground.
I know.
At the car. Like, oh my God. When he had, quote, used as many quarters as it took to get the red out, he put her in his trunk and drove all the way back home. Like, remember, he was like traveling to see his godchild. And then was like, never mind. And went back home. And put her in the shower with him, where he did God knows what to her body. And the detective, in his confession, he's like, yeah, well, I put her in, you know, we took a shower together. I think is the way he worded it. We took a shower together.
No, you did
not. And
so
the detective is like, did you like put soap on her body and stuff? And he's like, well... I mean, yeah, we were in the shower. So, yes, I soaped her.
Like, Jesus. Jesus. Okay. Like, Mary and Joseph. That's just...
Yeah, like the detective is crazy for being like, did you put soap on her? Because she's like, dead.
Of course I did.
He's like, what was I supposed to do? She was in the shower. Like, of course.
Well, and we're going to talk about it. But the way that he describes a lot of stuff, it's very much like, well, you know... This was a consensual thing. I'm like, no, the fuck, it was not.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Again, he didn't have enough time to dismember her and clean up before it was time to get Terry. So he wrapped her in packing paper and drove out to the levee to dump her body, not far from where he had left Joyce Williams. Marilyn's body was discovered on Halloween Day while a man was walking his dog. And sadly, no one had even reported that she was missing. Again, there was no evidence other than the packing paper, but that led investigators nowhere. And like all the others, her case went cold. And at this point, Gillis had been on a roll, but he was somehow able to restrain himself for the next 3 years. During this time, there were at least 5 active serial killers in the area.
Nope.
Not in the United States, just in this area.
No, no. No. How did Olivia, I know that you, it's, you know, backyard kind of case for you or whatever. I'm frightened for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I worry about you every damn day. Like,
I mean, goodness gracious. Yeah. Police initially thought there was one serial killer in the area that was killing all the people that they were killing, but no, it was actually 5.
Jeez.
Sex workers from the same place in North Baton Rouge that Gillis searched for victims kept showing up dead, but there were also affluent women being murdered in the safety of their own homes, which of course got more media attention. This was like a perfect storm for Gillis because he could fly under the radar without worrying about being caught and admire the, quote, work of the other killers for a while, especially Derek Todd Lee. He even had an entire folder on his computer dedicated to him, titled DTL. Wow, that's really clever. Nobody will know what you mean by that.
It's going to crack the code.
He said that he had preyed mostly on women who, quote, wouldn't be missed. This ended in 2003 when Derek Todley was captured and women thought their worries were over. They didn't know the so-called, quote, prostitute killer, and this is the media's name for the killer at the time, was still out there.
On October 9th, 2003, Gillis wasn't able to control his urges any longer, but this time it was way more personal. The woman he killed considered him a friend, and she had worked to clean his home for him. Williams had used and later become addicted to drugs, but before her drug use, she was a very attentive mother that catered food out of her home and braided hair in her home, excuse me. Johnny had known Gillis for about 10 years before, she had even invited him to a Thanksgiving dinner that she had cooked for her family a few years before when she had gotten clean. But unfortunately, she did relapse. On this October night, Gillis saw Johnny walking the streets of North Baton Rouge and he picked her up. He could tell that she was strung out on drugs and said that she looked like she was, quote, already dead. He drove to a secluded area behind a Cajun restaurant where he pulled Johnny out of the car and began savagely beating her until she was dead. Then he removed her clothes and began butchering her body with a knife. This time, he did a couple of things differently. He removed her hands and placed them in a Ziploc bag as a trophy he could take with him, and he did later dump them. Then he loaded her body in the front seat of his car and took her to a secluded spot near the woods in Pride, Louisiana, and disposed of her body on a trail off a dirt road. He posed with her body and took multiple and took multiple photos of it, which he actually showed to Terry later. And she was obviously disturbed, but she said that he was just weird.
And he also, I think this is the victim, because he took her hands. He painted her nails. Like,
all of it's wrong. Like, don't get me wrong, because I don't want to be like, painted her nails. That's sick. Because it's all sick. Yeah. It's just, why?
Like, she was your friend, so if you really, really wanted to paint her nails, she probably would have been like, sure, Sean, you can paint my nails. I don't care.
It's just so gross. A young boy found her body one day while he was riding four-wheelers with his friends on the trails and looking for his dog. Her body was identified with DNA, and a body hair in her arm was found that would end up being the key link to what law enforcement needed to tie the murders together later. But before that happened, her case went cold.
A couple of months later, in December 2003, Gillis found Donna Bennett Johnston stumbling along the streets in his normal hunting grounds. Donna had a great childhood, but had become a very young mother at just 15 years old. Later in her 20s, she was married twice and had two more children, but began having issues when her last husband began cheating on her. The downfall of her marriage is what started her alcoholism, which led her to abusing drugs. She had gone to rehab multiple times, but was not able to get clean and eventually got a divorce. After the divorce, she and her husband still saw each other and had two more children. She began supporting herself and her kids with sex work while living with her mother, but her life kept spiraling out of control. Donna was no stranger to being on the receiving end of abuse from the men who paid her for sex and had been arrested for solicitation, drugs, and theft. When Gillis picked her up that night, offering to pay for oral sex, she got in his car, he drove to a secluded area, and he strangled her with a zip tie. She was able to jump out of the car and started running, but he caught her and finished strangling her until she was dead. You have to wonder if this is something that he actually enjoys. This is the third time that we know of that that happened.
Right.
And you would think after the first time you would take precautions for it not to happen again. But who was it? Richard Ramirez said that he liked to see the fear
in
the victim's eyes.
Like, yes.
Like, I want, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wonder if that's something that like,
it was like he hunted time, them.
Man. Yeah. 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 Oh, God. He put her back in the car, drove to a secluded area in the woods, and began dismembering her body. He also removed a butterfly tattoo that was on her right thigh. He cut off her arm, which he wrapped in a dish towel, put the piece of skin with the tattoo in a paper towel, and took 45 pictures of her body once he placed her in his trunk, posing her in different positions. And luckily for law enforcement, he got almost all of his license plate in these photos too. So, idiot. He disposed of her body off of Ben Hur Road, not far from his home. He posed her, put her jacket over her face, and stomped on her back, leaving a bloody shoe print. Then he drove the paper towel with her tattooed skin to a different location, sunk it in a water-filled ditch, and drove further again to dump the arm. Jeez.
On March 3rd, 2004, a task force was assembled to try to solve the deaths of Donna Johnston, Catherine Hall, Johnny Mae Williams, and other cold cases that held similarities to the nature of their murders. And it didn't take long for them to realize that they were trying to find another serial killer. The FACES lab, which is Forensic Anthropology and Computer Enhancement Services at LSU, examined Donna Johnston's body and found a body hair where her wrist had been severed. This hair was sent for examination to the FBI crime lab in Washington, D.C., along with the hair with the root ball intact that had been recovered from Catherine Hall's mouth. The DNA from under Donna's fingernails matched the hair from Catherine's mouth, so they knew they were looking for the same killer. Then they focused on the tire tracks they had found at Donna's crime scene. They found out exactly what brand, model, and size the tire was, which was a Goodyear Aquatread, and got a list of everyone who had purchased them in the Baton Rouge area. Everyone on that list had to submit their DNA.
And it's interesting because this is just one of those situations where he happened to have a very rare tire. Like, not a lot of people had this tire.
We love to hear
luckily.
It.
Luckily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On April 28th, 2004, law enforcement showed up at Gillis's door to take his DNA and requested for him to go to the station for an interview. He answered all the questions very calmly. He even laughed and joked with the police officers. He placed himself at Donna's crime scene where he said he had stopped to pee in the woods, even though it was close enough that he could just like go home to his own bathroom and use it. So immediately cops were like, this is sus, like super sus.
Super sus.
Even though he kept insisting that he's, you know, I didn't do it. I'm not the dude, man.
Yeah. And they asked him too. They're like, why didn't you just go home? Like, you were right there. And he's like, well, I mean, you know the phrase, my eyeballs were floating. Like, it was like one of those situations. Like, it was just crazy. I just had to go right then.
I mean, when nature calls, but like, duh, that's so stupid. Why would, well, a lot of men just really, or boys, I don't know, they love to pee outside. What is that about?
They really do, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But that's not what the issue was here. That's not it.
No.
So when a new investigator came in and they got on the topic of serial killers, Gillis went as far to say, quote, he had no interest in seeing a grisly crime scene. But then he continued to talk excitedly about crime scenes of different serial killers, even saying that, quote, Jeffrey Dahmer was fun.
That was fun.
Don't that fun? No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
After he was released from the interview that evening, the task force got a warrant to search his car and started watching his house while they waited for the DNA, the results of the DNA. Later that night, they got the results of a positive match to Gillis, and at 1:20 in the morning, a SWAT team busted into his and Terry's house and arrested him. Gillis looked at Terry and just said, quote, I'm sorry, while he was taken away. And Terry, of course, she's like, absolutely not. You guys have the wrong guy. Like, that is so ridiculous. That did not, she said he didn't have it in him to kill.
Mm-hmm.
But at the station, Gillis was totally laid back. He was laughing and joking again while he told investigators everything, and he enjoyed every second of it. He didn't spare any detail, and investigators had to pretend like they weren't disgusted completely.
I don't know how they do that.
I don't either.
They're just like, oh, okay, so you, you used the same knife. Oh, did you put soap on her? Oh, you painted her nails.
Uh-huh. Huh?
Okay. You painted it. Okay. Like,
how I'm feeling is all right here. So if that was me listening to this, I'd be like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, and he just like, he had really weird explanations for stuff before he started confessing to everything.
Yeah.
So like at first he's like, they're like, well, are we, you know, what if we find blood in your car and stuff like that. He's like, oh, well, you know what that is from is because Terry was sitting in the car in her and she had her got her period. And so blood went everywhere. I mean, it was splashed all over everywhere.
Oh, come on.
And it's like, they're like, we know how periods work. Like, no, that's not how that works. And at one point he said that the windows had been down and maybe because they were like, well, what about like blood in the back seat? And he's like, well, she got her period. She wasn't expecting it. Obviously that got everywhere, but the windows were down. So some of the blood went out of the window and came back into the back.
If anyone out there is watching and you haven't experienced having a period, it's not like Old Faithful.
No.
So that's physically impossible. I just don't understand. What a fucking idiot. So I'm not trying to say that his mom was delusional, but he sure as shit is not a genius. I'll say that.
Exactly.
Case in point.
Yeah. And he's so arrogant that he thinks that the investigators are going to be like, who I'm sure some of them have wives or at the very least have had girlfriends. Some of them have maybe daughters or whatever. And he's like, oh, well, I mean, you know, as well as I know that when a woman gets her period, if she's not expecting it, it just explodes everywhere. Like, that's not what happens. Obviously.
Right. That is so ridiculous. But yes, of course. I mean, he obviously was incredibly arrogant and just thought that they would be like, oh yeah, you're right. Oh, I didn't think about that. Okay. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, investigators can sense this. They can see that he's arrogant. So they use that to their advantage to play up his ego and get him to continue to talk, which, God, people are so good with that kind of stuff. I love it. He talked to them for several days and he was proud of himself and how he had outsmarted the police for over 10 years. He talked about all the different types of knives he used to cut up his victims and enjoyed reenacting how he used zip ties to strangle them while using sound effects. He showed no remorse for his victims whose lives he stole. And until later when he wrote Tammy Perpera, a friend of Donna Johnston, letters from prison apologizing for what he did. He blamed his actions on that he, quote, hated God for a while. However, and Mark says it too, like, it's just, there was no, like, I don't think that he just had this moment where he was like, oh my gosh, what have I done? I really need to, like, repent. And I think he just wanted to relive his crimes and just be a dick.
Yeah, just be a dick. Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, MISSKB, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode?
Yeah, we do have different tiers, so just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB. He has a couple different trials. So the first is the trial of Joyce Williams. Carrie Cuccia was Gillis's defense lawyer and filed multiple motions to suppress evidence, have experts test evidence, and to suppress confessions because Gillis had technically asked for an attorney initially, but then kept talking. And what he actually said was, I guess I should have brought a lawyer with me, but then he keeps talking. And so
that to me is, I know, but it's not a request, you know, like, oh, shoot, should have brought one, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And then he kept talking. So they couldn't use any of this information that he'd given them. And he gave them every bit of information. Mm-hmm. All of these motions delayed the trial from 2004 to 2007. The prosecutor representing the state in West Baton Rouge Parish was Tony Clayton, and Judge Robin Free presided over the trial. In August 2007, Gillis pled guilty to second-degree murder in a plea bargain in which he was reserved the right to appeal if he pled guilty. This was offered in exchange for the use of his confession. He received a sentence of life in prison at the Angola State Penitentiary. On July 21st, 2008, the two-part trial, guilty and penalty phases for the first-degree murder of Donna Bennett Johnston, commenced. Judge Bonnie Jackson presided over the trial, and she threw out the videotaped confession because he had asked for this attorney. And this is a huge blow to the prosecution. And he did keep talking after, but, you know, I mean, that throws it out, right? Carrie Cuccia was Gillis's defense lawyer again. Prim Burns was the prosecutor for the state and was able to get a journalist who Gillis had confessed to for a story to testify on their behalf. So,
gotcha.
No, we can't use the confession that we have, but he talked to other people and we can use that. Like, this fucking idiot.
Yeah.
She was also able to use evidence from the other cases in the penalty phase of the trial to prove that Gillis was a serial killer. Prim Burns used three letters that Gillis wrote to Donna's friend Tammy as her nail in Gillis's coffin for this case. In the letters, he wrote, quote, "I cannot express how beyond sorry I am for murdering Donna, Johnny Mae, Lillian, Marilyn, Joyce, Hardy, Catherine, and Anne. Tell me you're a serial killer without telling me you're a serial killer."
Yeah, like, you just said it.
Exactly. But he also said, "For your own sake, Tammy, you must forgive the sinner, but you may hate the sin forever."
Okay, well, first of all, you're not in a position to tell me what the fuck to do, Sean Vincent Gillis, so...
Absolutely not. Oh my gosh, like, how infuriating. He then went into detail about how he brutally murdered Donna Johnston.
See, and this is the reason why not... I mean, I haven't read the entire letter that he sent or letters that he sent. But yeah. That sentence all by itself, the very last one that you read, shows me that he... It's not about him showing remorse.
No.
He's just like, I just want to talk about it. And also like, you have to forgive me. You have to forgive me. You have to forgive me. Like,
mm-hmm.
Okay, well, no, the fuck I don't.
Yeah, but remember when I killed your friend?
Yes. Yes.
Like reminiscing about it together. Like, yeah. Remember when that happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. The defense only presented evidence that Donna had led a, quote, high risk lifestyle by providing her arrest records, but the prosecution already had this kind of testimony. The jury knew that she was on drugs, that she was a sex worker, so it really didn't make any difference. The prosecution had already beaten the defense to the punch and had told them that information. And also, it doesn't matter.
No. If you, like, whatever kind of lifestyle you live, does that mean that you had it coming?
Exactly. Like, okay, so maybe she did get into cars with other people. You might be able to, if we don't have a DNA match to him or something, you might be able to say, as a defense attorney, I see what they're trying to do here. Well, she got into cars with people she didn't know all the time. It could have been any one of the people that she got into a car with. That's not the situation we have here.
Mm-mm.
So talking about her, quote, high-risk lifestyle does you no fucking good. And It just disparages the victim of a murder.
And also, let's not forget that he confessed. Now, we can't use the first confession because of reasons, whatever. But that's not the only confession we have. So, like, I was just joshing 19 times when I told everybody about, like, come on.
Exactly. Although, in the Henry Lee Lucas case, that did happen, but still. It's
okay,
different.
But that's not what we're talking about right now, okay? Must you remember everything?
Well, you know somebody in the comments is going to be like, well, Henry Lee Lucas did it.
I know.
Like,
cover our asses here.
We know that there are false confessions, but this is not one of them.
Right.
Yeah. In closing arguments, Cuccia tried to explain that it didn't matter how bad the nature of the murder was because it didn't mean it was premeditated. And he tried to prove this because under Louisiana law, you have to prove specific intent with the, quote, plus factor. The plus factor being something like kidnapping or armed robbery. And that's like, we see that in other states too. He tried to say that just because Gillis had items of the victims in his possession the black belt that she was wearing that belonged to her daughter in this case doesn't mean he, quote, robbed her of them.
Would she have given it to him if he hadn't killed her?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But we'll never know.
Yeah, true.
But probably. Yeah. Is what he thinks.
Right.
The
premeditated thing pisses me off, because the way that I look at premeditation, and I think a lot of people do, the word premeditated means, you know, if I'm going by that definition, he absolutely premeditated these murders. Because how have you ever driven around with a bag full of industrial zip ties? No. Have you ever driven around with a knife? No.
Well, and the term he used was hunting.
Yeah.
I was hunting.
I mean, out of all of the 8 murders that he committed, at least, what, let's say 5 of them were done with by stabbing and by the zip tie.
Mm-hmm. What'd you bring that stuff for?
Right. Why do you need it?
Well, and even strangling somebody or stabbing them. You stab somebody one time and then you stop, they might survive it. You stab somebody 47 times, you had 46 of those that you knew they were going to die if you kept going. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. But he also did keep items. And so that is technically, I it's just so frustrating that, like, you have to argue the semantics of, is this robbery or not robbery, even though, like, he took something of hers that didn't belong to him. It's robbery. Like,
okay, but kidnapping, couldn't you use... I just watched Legally Blonde recently, so I am a lawyer, obviously. I learned a lot. Law is reason, free from passion. I get it. But they're running away, right? And he attacks them. Would that not be considered some form of kidnapping?
Or, yeah, I mean, or putting them in a car. Like, okay, this person got into the car, but under the pretense that she's free to leave. Well, she's not free to leave. So that's kidnapping.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, like it just... But not only that, you guys, he also tried to disprove that the black belt was even hers, even though her daughter identified it. But he said, well, there was no DNA of Donna's found on it, so it could not have been hers.
Okay, Carrie.
Yeah. At the end of her closing argument, Prim Burns took a zip tie, tightened it, and counted out loud for 60 seconds, which is about how long the pathologist had stated it would take for the victim to lose consciousness. I love this strategy when used appropriately, because we had to do this at a restaurant that I worked at, because we had to greet our table within 60 seconds. If you went longer than a minute by getting your ass over to the table, or asking somebody else to do it if you were busy, then you got in trouble. And he made us sit there in this training, all of us sit there, and we had to be completely silent for one full minute.
And you don't realize how long.
That feels like an eternity. Yeah.
But even still, which, I mean, it's a great tactic for lots of different reasons. I don't think I would have even realized how beneficial it is for what you're talking about. But this is just to lose consciousness. It's not to kill him.
Correct. It's not to kill him. That's longer.
Mm-hmm.
3 to 6 minutes is what we've seen in a lot of cases. So that's a long ass time.
A long ass time.
The jury deliberated from 1:50 p.m. to 5:15 p.m. And the verdict was unanimous. Gillis was guilty of first degree murder. Sucks to suck.
But we love to see it.
Exactly. The penalty phase that would decide whether he would be sentenced to death or life imprisonment began the morning after the verdict was read. It was then that Prim Burns was able to present additional evidence about the other victims, but she was only able to talk about 2 of them because of a ruling the judge had previously made about not admitting his videotape confession into evidence. Close friends and family testified on Gillis's behalf and said that they never thought he could have done anything like this and were completely shocked. The defense tried to indicate that Gillis could not help his actions because he was mentally ill. And Dr. Reuben Gurr, a neuropsychologist, was called as an expert to try and convince the jury that Gillis was mentally ill with schizoaffective disorder due to brain abnormalities and a brain injury. But like, what's the brain injury? When did that happen?
No idea.
Dr. Dorothy Lewis was also called as an expert psychiatrist for the defense. She was an expert on serial killers and had previously examined Ted Bundy. She went over Gillis's father's family history of mental illness and migraines. and stated that since Gillis also had migraines, that they could have caused him to have a neurological disorder in addition to some frontal lobe damage from some accidents as an adolescent. However, there was no evidence of any of these accidents that were mentioned besides verification from his mother and some other family members. And experts for the prosecution had reviewed his brain scans and found them to be normal. So it's not like he ever received medical care for a specific injury where he hit his head or something like that.
Right.
During Joyce's daughter's testimony, Gillis had the audacity to mouth the words, "I'm sorry," to her. And when she asked why did he do this to her mama, he said, quote, "I don't know. I'm sorry. I loved your mama. I love you, Lauren."
That would be the moment where I would produce some sort of a weapon and just,
hi-ya! You may fuck all the way off.
Yeah.
I mean, the jury deliberated for a little over 2.5 hours and then announced that they were deadlocked and unable to reach a unanimous verdict, which is required for the death penalty in Louisiana. The judge sentenced Gillis to life imprisonment with hard labor. That's going to be the worst part for Sean Gillis. He don't do the hard labor shit.
Yeah, I feel like working is worse than hell for Sean Vincent
Gillis. Like, and now you're actually going to have to hold a job, bitch, and you're not going to be able to not go.
And it's called hard labor.
Hard labor, yeah. And no parole to be served in Angola State Penitentiary. The victims' families who all attended the trials were devastated. They were really hoping for the death penalty.
Gillis's last trial was on February 17, 2009 in Lafayette for the murder of Marilyn Nevels. He pled guilty to first-degree murder and was again sentenced to life imprisonment. Justice for the other victims would not be served because it would have been a waste of tax dollars to have more trials for someone who would never be getting out of prison. But the families had to live with knowing that as taxpayers, they were paying for him to live the rest of his life being fed on their dime. Gillis was a rare type of serial killer because his motive was that he wanted to just, quote, get off from engaging in necrophilia and later cannibalism with the corpses of those he murdered. However, his killings were not driven by anger or rage towards women like other serial killers in the sexual sadist category. He thought of what he was doing as a game with law enforcement. This is evidenced by the fact that he was extremely brazen about when and where he attacked and how and where he left the bodies, and was not careful to not leave any evidence behind. He liked that law enforcement couldn't connect anything to him. He was also not abused as a child, like some killers who have been classified under the, like, quote, nurture piece of the nurture versus nature psychiatric theory. However, he did most likely inherit mental illness from his father, which could tie him to the nature theory. And he also didn't exhibit any signs of the McDonald triad, unless you count Star Trek.
Star Trek, yes. That's the eighth part of the McDonald triad.
Exactly. We've added like a lot to the triad for sure. He seems like he really didn't have a particular type, except for when he started hunting for sex workers, or as he said, quote, people that wouldn't be missed, which, jokes on you, yes, the fuck they were. But he deviated from that sometimes as well. He didn't seem to favor one particular race, age, or anything besides that all of his victims were petite so that he could be sure that he would either overpower them or outrun them. And when asked how he could get them in the car, he said, quote, "I act like I'm literally trying to pick them up on a real date." And these are his words, not mine, so just understand that. "The hookers love me. I treated them like women, like ladies. Do you understand? That was the smoothness, I guess, to where some of them, they couldn't wait to get into my car. And the money, although, was the immediate motivating factor of them being there. They were wanting to ride with me, to be with me."
Are you serious? You think that you, and if you've seen a picture of this man, okay,
yeah.
He thinks he is the motivation for these women to get in the car because he's so fucking smooth that they can't wait to get in the car. It has nothing to do with the fact that you have offered to pay them.
Right.
That's the same thing as like people who, when a waitress comes over to fucking take your drink order or whatever, and they're like, "Wow, she asked me if I needed anything else. Like,
dude, she talked to me."
That's our job.
Yeah.
That's how she gets paid.
You're not the prize.
No.
The money is the prize.
Oh my gosh.
The ego on this. Well, and you know what? Not to be whatever, but I blame his mama. Because she was always like, you are perfect. Everything well, you do is yeah. amazing.
And I saw in one of his, like in part of his confession video, he said about his mom, because they asked him, like, do you have like a mom thing too? Because, you know, a lot of times serial killers do. And he said, well, I mean, yeah, like she was not an unattractive woman, even now that she's older. She's still attractive. Like, I can see that. And he's like, I always said, if you guys didn't catch me first when she passed away, you'd find me in bed with her. And they were like, did you want to have sex with her? And he was like, well, yeah.
Oh, my God.
She's not unattractive.
He just gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. I'm going to need either a shower or... to say some Hail Mary, I don't know. I'm going to need to watch a good movie. This is not, it's too much. When asked why he killed all of the women, Gillis replied, quote, they were already dead to me.
Well, of course they were.
Yeah.
He didn't view them as humans.
No.
What an a-hole.
And that is the case.
Yeah, that's the case. We love you guys. We want to know what you think about it. Thanks again to Olivia for requesting this. And again, Olivia, blink twice if you're safe.
Yes. I'm scared for you. I need to put you in a friggin' bubble.
I know. Oof.
But anyway, thank you guys so much. We love you. Bye.
Bye. Hey, you guys. It's shout out time.
Yay.
We are just so grateful for each and every one of you who is hanging out in the Patreon with us. We could not appreciate you anymore. And we want to give a hey girl thanks to Rebecca,
Noel,
Emily Smith,
Lee Weaver,
Ariel Stowe,
Joshua,
Katie,
Olivia Perry.
This is kind of all together. Megan Vansadal,
Vanistal, Savannah White,
Amber C,
Clementine Brooks,
Adele,
Avon,
Emma Krause,
Jasmine Barnhart,
Taylor Black,
Kayla Raya,
Jacqueline Oriana,
Hannah Eastaff,
Sasha Hamilton,
Carrie Ahern,
Ava Kelly,
Aisha Warsham,
Catherine Finnell,
Stevie Drew,
Janine Tinsley,
Stacy Baucus,
Kara Roach,
Lauren Fergus,
Helga Magnus Dottir,
Tay,
Katie Berry,
Emily J,
Sydney Skinner,
Emily England,
Lucy H,
Colleen,
Lauren Schultz,
and Taylor Campbell.
You guys, thank you so, so much. We love you. If we fucked your name all the way up, we are so sorry, but we can't read.
Yes, and we just could not do this without you. We love you. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye!
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.
This podcast...
to a great start.
This episode contains discussion of assault, gun violence, and murder. Listen to script.
Oh.
This epitome.
Epitode. Oh, man, that's going to put me off soup for a while.
Well, it's a mix. Nope. You know what happened?
What?
I'm stupid. And thank you to Olivia for writing this one up. Oh,
yay.
Oh, shit. I'm so sorry. I choked on my own self. But what emerged from that was a methodology. That feels wrong in my mouth. It's a vibe. Prohibited from all contract.
Oh, my. He's got some mansome.
His upbringing.
Oh my.
Because David was an ordained minister. But she, I just think from a rehabilitation.
Oh my. God bless it.
All right, grow up.
I'm sick of this.
Jerson?
Nope.
You did it again. I just told you. So don't you funny. Do it again.
Oh, there's a third.
Oh my God. Don't you even.
Oh God.
Okay.
Grew I'm allergic up. To not sneezing. Apparently. I know. Oh my God. I feel like there's a fourth Torella.
You've got to be kidding me.
I know. It's lingering.
I mean, I'm itchy, but I'm not sneezing because I'm a grown up.
Oh my God.
Tried to stop now it. Now you're a toddler because all toddlers do is walk around and sneeze and cough.
Okay, I think I'm good now.
You know, he's like, well, Cambridge is a different city. It's a different jurisdiction.
Oh my.
Pick up on thermal energy. So, no.
Was the authoritarianism.
Why are you going to blast it?
I just want to see it.
It's your chance. Do your dance at the jock. Damn it.
He believed that people were following Tim.
Whoa. Who's Tim?
Philadelphia retired police and firemen association circus fundraiser. And, you know, Lisa was like, oh, bless you. Lisa was like, oh my God.
Are you finished?
Probably not.
Okay. Bless you. This was not 50 kids. This was thousands.
Thousands? Your stupidity makes me laugh so much.
She had that cute little bond blob.
A bond blob. Boast with.
Are you fucking kidding me? Just like this, where they were like, okay, well, he's. Ow. God.
What the fuck?
So we watched the show called. Fuck. A medical examiner told the court that Matt died from asphyxiation.
You need to really quit drinking during the day. Subdermal hemorrhaging and retinal hemorrhaging. Oh, hemorrhaging. Oh, I can't do it. I did it twice. Oh, God.
Hemorrhaging. Just hemorrhaging. Think about Veda I know. And my girl. I'm hemorrhaging. It's a small town in East Missouri near the Illinois
Oh, my.
I was going to say birder.
I'm sorry. I'm about to make this really like man, female, a female.
I know. It's like you have a whole fucking theme going and then you're just like, oh, shit.
What?
I got to put the laundry out real quick.
Oh, my God. Fucking we're never going to do this. We're never going to do it. Smoke that weed. I hate him, but I like to do him.
Now, they couldn't see who was driving the Malibu.
Are we taking crazy pills today?
Why?
We're acting a fucking fool.
Oh, this feels pretty normal to me, but.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But they,
Justice Minotaur,
Oh my.
Justice Minotaur, oh my God. Oh. There's an S in that word. Okay.
On Friday, September, I knew it. As soon as I started it, I knew it.
His citizens.
Oh my. I know a lot about bunnies.
And beyond oh my God. Oh.
The call was eventually traced to a currency exchange in the Vancouver.
Oh. She always got a caramel macchiato from Starbucks.
Oh
my God.
The local 911 dispatch center received a call from a Hysterica brindle. Oh.
And a substance similar to fingerprint So the deputy ME asked the investigator to smell the bottom and it had an almond.
The bottom?
What did I say? Really?
You said the bottom.
Whose bottom? Smell my bottom.
No! Nobody wants to smell your bottom.
If you want to find out if your Tylenol is laced with cyanide, you must smell my bottom.
Oh my God.
And if it smells like almonds, thank you very much, then your Tylenol is laced with cyanide. If if robbery was a motive.
In September, no. Why did I even? Love that chicken Popeyes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That one. Yeah. Despite her infamous C U M I E. Is it Cumi?
A bang bang.
My brain said bloop.
Why? Why? Why is this? Why?
And the perception within most of law enforcement and
was did quick question. You using your iPods on September
21st. Dead ass gunshot.
Yeah.
No cap. No cap.
Stop it.